When I first began attending Church of God services in 1971, it was common for church areas at that time to meet together, especially for Holy Day celebrations. In fact, the first two or three Holy Days I attended was with my local church in Hagerstown in Western Maryland, and then also we met with churches in either Baltimore, Maryland, or Washington, D.C. And that was in the late 60s, early 70s, that was kind of a common thing to really make the Holy Day time very, very special. You'd get together with maybe a larger church if you were a smaller church, and the smaller church as well in Hagerstown, a small church was about 250 people, how times change. And then sometimes if you went to a metropolitan area, there might be 1,000 people or 1,500 people that would get together for a holy day, like, for instance, the first or second day of Unleavened Bread or Pentecost or Atonement or whatever, and then all would get together at a large Feast of Tabernacle sites back in those days. In Terry's home church of Corpus Christi, it was part of a circuit for many years with San Antonio, and they would get together at a kind of a, I think sometimes they met in Beeville, Texas. I don't think it was halfway for the San Antonio people, but someplace in South Texas they would get together and they would have a very large group of people meeting for a holy day. And that's the way her life was when she was growing up in the church. When the Tucson church was begun in Worldwide Church of God, and it was the 56th congregation of the United States established by Worldwide Church of God, so it was, you know, really, eventually we'd have well over 300 congregations, maybe even 400 around the United States. So it was a relatively early one. I can't remember exact date, but it was sometime in the 60s. Before that, all the members here that were in the church would drive up to Phoenix. And a lot of times during those early years of when there was a pastor that pastored both Tucson and Phoenix, naturally a lot of people would, they would have the holy days combined with the Phoenix brethren in many cases, so you'd have a very large group of people up in that area. And later on, as the church grew and there were more and more congregations in Tucson, for instance, we had a sister congregation in Sierra Vista. When I got here, there were about 80 people that were in attendance there, and most of the time, most every holy day, the same thing would happen. We would get together and we would be with Sierra Vista. The Phoenix churches would get together oftentimes, and I've been to some of the holy days where they've, as a group of churches, would get together. Now, even today, it's not uncommon for some of our members to go visit in other areas, right? There are people here who go to Phoenix and attend from time to time, and we have visitors from Phoenix that are attending here, and that's not an uncommon thing to do. And I think one time, some of the members here who had never met any of the El Paso members drove over, some of the ladies drove over and met and got to know some of the El Paso members maybe 10 or 12 years ago. So if someone were to ask you, hey, let's plan on visiting the Phoenix Church two Sabbaths from now, that wouldn't be unusual, right? And if you were all friends and you were sharing the driving and the costs and everything associated, you'd probably be pretty happy to do that. And I know some of you do that. And if you were living in another part of the country, if somebody said, if you lived in Phoenix, for instance, somebody said, hey, let's go up to northern Arizona and attend with the folks up there, that would be entirely reasonable. Am I right? Some nods of heads? Okay, good. But if somebody said to you, hey, let's attend in Laodicea this week, you would very likely be horrified and say, no way, if you knew where Laodicea was meeting. You would recoil in horror at going to Laodicea for church services, I would guess. I mean, most people would. Why would you be so repulsed about going to church in Laodicea? Have you ever thought about that? I mean, you probably haven't, because I never had until coming up with this sermon idea. In the 50s and the 60s AD, 2,000 years ago, I think going to church in Laodicea might have been a pretty good thing. It would have been just as good as going to any other churches that are mentioned in Revelation 2 and 3 to go to services, because as we'll explain today in the sermon and then maybe a little bit more in the Bible study today, Laodicea was actually grouped in with the first historical church, which was called the Ephesian era. Now, for those of you that may be new and may not have the background, don't worry, it'll come with time. And we'll cover a little bit of that in the Bible study today. But Laodicea, back in the day, back when Paul or when John was writing to them, and Paul was actually writing to them as well, was a very stable, very solid church area from a historical standpoint. There would have been nothing wrong with it. In fact, nothing that I can find within the scriptures and within the documentation about Laodicea, anciently speaking, would lead you to believe that it was a bad place or that the church area was a bad place from a historical standpoint. But if I said today, hey, let's go find out where Laodicea is meeting and let's all go there this week, this Sabbath, you'd think I was crazy, and you probably wouldn't want to go to Laodicea to attend church services. Laodicea was, it may have been the nicest church area of the ancient world. Now, I can't prove that, but we do know that it was a wealthy area from a historical standpoint, and the people there were God's people, just like they were in Ephesus and Thyatira and all the other church areas that were in the ancient world. But why wouldn't you want to go there today? Why wouldn't you want to go there next week? Understanding the answer to that question may help us to understand better not only what John was writing about in 95-96 AD, or what Christ was warning the church at that time, and what he was warning of the Laodiceans about, it might help us to understand the world in which we live today a little bit better. I think that if you'll turn with me to Revelation chapter 3 and verse 14, maybe we'll get an idea of why you probably, those of you that have been around for a while, probably wouldn't want to go to Laodicea for services today. The title of the message today is Attending in Laodicea. And I'd like to help answer the question as to why you're probably repulsed at the thought of ever going to Laodicea for church services if you know anything about Laodicea as it's described in Revelation 3. So we read in Revelation 3 and verse 14, and to the angel of the church of the Laodiceans write, these things says the Amen, the faithful and true witness, the beginning of the creation of God. I know your works, that you're neither hot nor cold. I could wish that you were cold or hot, so then because you are lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will vomit you out of my mouth, because you say, I am rich, have become wealthy, and have need of nothing. And do not know that you are wretched, miserable, poor, blind, and naked. I counsel you to buy from me gold refined in the fire, that you may be rich, and white garments, that you may be clothed, that the shame of your nakedness may not be revealed, and anoint your eyes with eye salve, and repent. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him and dine with him, and he with me. To him who overcomes, I will grant to sit with me on my throne, as I also overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. Christ said that he knew their works, but I think that you can infer from reading this basic condemnation of this particular group of people that they really had no works to speak of. They thought they were rich. They thought they were self-sufficient. They thought they didn't need anything. But in reality, they were miserable, poor, blind, and naked. So how does all of that condemnation translate in a spiritual sense? Before we answer that question, let's explore what I believe to be a fairly common myth within the congregations of the Church of God. Because although I kind of made fun in the introduction of attending church in Laodicea, I think it is a commonly held belief that at some point you might be able to point, not you, but this is a common thought or has been expressed through the decades, at least since I have been in the church. If you've never heard it and you've been in it as long as I, then please correct me later. But it is a commonly expressed thought regarding Laodicea that maybe you could point to a specific group of people. Now, that has even seemed to gain a little bit more speed or a little bit more of a, you know, the snowball rolling down the hill since the complete breakup of Worldwide Church of God in the early 90s. Because we all know, you know, this is the elephant in the room, that we are not the only group in United Church of God that are doing the things that should be done by God's people during the time of the end, keeping the Sabbath day and observing the feast days, the annual feast days, you know, every year. But it has been kind of a commonly expressed notion that you might be able to point to a specific group of people and say, I think that group is Laodicean. Since the time that you have come into the church, and for those of you that have been around a while, have you ever heard anybody express that, whether an official from the ministerial, from the pulpit, or just a thought expressed by anybody? Has anybody heard that? Please show me a raise of hands if you have. Okay, then I can continue with the sermon since I have some affirmation and I don't have to quit right now because my hypothesis is basically ruined. I think I've told you the story about a friend of mine that was preaching at the Feast of Tabernacles, and he was trying to make the point. I've given this example before, but some of you online have not heard it. He's trying to make the example that, you know, our life is in the kingdom of God, not in the treasures of this life. And, you know, that he said, for instance, he said, let me ask you, how many of you, this was big back in the day when it was a big magazine, how many of you have ever won anything in the Reader's Digest sweepstakes? And he paused, and there was about 3,000 people in the audience. And he said, that's what I thought. So the next summer, when he and I were planning for that next year's feast, we were out in the backyard, and we were having a refreshment. And I looked at him. I said, you know, last year you made this comment, and you asked, you know, you said, how many people have ever won the Reader's Digest sweepstakes? And I know what the whole premise behind your thought was that no one would have raised their hand. I said, but I was in the front and I never turned around. I said, did you have anybody raise their hand? He says, yeah, there was about 7 or 8 people that raised their hands. So I said, you just went on with it then. That's what I thought. Like nobody had raised their hands. He said, exactly. Well, for those of you that are watching online, there were about half of the audience here today that raised their hands. They have heard the notion or the idea that Laodicea is an era that you could identify that would be similar to the previous eras. And one of the things that we'll be covering in the Bible study is the historical analysis of the people through the ages, through the last 2,000 years since 31 AD, and identifying those people through the ages. And we pretty much have identified all of them up to the Philadelphia Church and continuing the Philadelphia Church. And let me just say that I think that anybody that would hear this message would proudly proclaim themselves to be in the Philadelphia era as a historical or a prophetic sense. Am I right? I mean, that is the era that Jesus has nothing against. all the other errors he, you know, gives some correction to. This one is, and I think that all of us want to be considered Philadelphian, and that's why you would recoil in horror if somebody said, hey, let's go to the Laodicean congregation and attend there. But I think that that would be fallacious because I don't think there is a congregation. And so I'll go contrarian to the popular notion that has sometimes been expressed that there is a group of people that you could actually point to and say, oh, that is a Laodicean attitude, because I don't think that group exists. Bold statement, personal opinion. I don't think it will ever exist as a group that would have like a minister in charge, a headquarters area, a home office area, or anything like that. And I'll explain that as we go through. In fact, I'm pretty confident that the previously expressed idea that there might be a group of people that you could specify and point to and say that's Laodicean does not exist and, in fact, may never exist. Shocking? I don't know if that's shocking to you. So let's begin with this foundation. I guess we're not beginning because we're minutes into the 16 minutes in. We believe, and I see nothing to dispute that belief. And I know that not everybody shares that belief, and they may be attending with us. But the teaching of the church, which I do hold to be correct, is that when we look at Revelation chapter 2 and 3, and we see this list of churches beginning with Ephesus, and then see the last one, which is Laodicea, we believe that that is a historical reference of groups of people throughout the last 2,000 years that you could identify as the people of God or the church of God through the ages. And as we get into the book of Revelation, we are going to take a lot of time with that, at least one Bible study on each of those specific churches to describe them. I gave a series a number of years ago on that, and I'll use some of that information if, you know, Mr. Horchak's got a lot of information to share as well. But that's basically our teaching, that we feel that we can identify people and leaders and congregations and attitudes and things that were happening in the world at the time in which these people lived, that we could actually say, as we have been taught, that that was God's people in the Middle Ages, for instance. So I think that there's enough historical evidence to help us with that premise. But for every period up to the Philadelphia area, you can identify, you know, depending on how far back you go in history, you can identify even church headquarters. You can identify where people called it a headquarters or an office or a place in which activities of the church were distributed. I don't believe that you can say the same thing about the last church that is mentioned. So for those of you that may be unaware, let me just say this, that I think that incorrectly through the decades that I've been in the church, there's been a lot of finger pointing, you know, this and that group, especially after other groups of people began to decouple themselves for good reason from Worldwide Church of God for various reasons. And there has been a lot of finger pointing, which we shouldn't do in my opinion, about this group or that group being Laodicean. So I say baloney to all of that, because I don't think there will ever be a time in the future in which there will be a headquarters office that, you know, nobody would call themselves the headquarters office of the Laodicean era. You know, some churches have taken the name of Philadelphia. That's, you know, their prerogative, I suppose, Philadelphia Church of God, one prominent one. But nobody's going to stand up in line and go down to a state office and apply for a tax exemption for the Laodicean Church of God. That is just very unlikely to happen, because we understand that there's only condemnation towards this group of people. But let's take a look at a little bit of the history of these people, and let me try to clarify my statement that if you were to go back to 55 AD, you would have no problem in going to Laodicea for services. You would not have the same type of animus towards associating with that group then as you might have, as I said, hey, let's go to Laodicea today and attend there. Let's look at Acts chapter 19 and verse 1. This was towards the beginning of the establishment of the Church of Asia Minor. And in Acts chapter 19 and verse 1, it happened while Apollos was at Corinth that Paul, having passed through the upper regions, came to Ephesus and found some disciples. Now, I won't go through all the verses, but to shorten, you know, this, give you a little bit of a synopsis, he found disciples of John the Baptist. They had been baptized prior to the time in which the Holy Spirit was given at the day of Pentecost. And they were asked, hey, did you receive the Holy Spirit since you've been baptized? They said, what's that? And so the explanation was given and kind of a recounting of what had happened on the day of Pentecost in 31 AD. And guess what? All those people were rebaptized, had hands laid on them, and they received the gift of the Holy Spirit. In verse 9, we read, but some were hardened and did not believe, but spoke evil of the way before the multitude. He departed from them, withdrew from the disciples, remaining daily in the school of Tyrannus. And this continued for 2 years, so that all who dwelt in Asia heard the word of the Lord Jesus, both Jews and Greeks. There was a tremendous proclamation of the gospel in the area that we call Turkey today. That's the nation, that's the modern nation state today, but all of these towns that are mentioned in Revelation 2 and 3 were located in what ancient maps describe as Asia Minor. But there were no Turks there at that time. There were Greeks, and there were Romans, and there were Jews, and there may have been a few other nationalities, but the Turks were not there. The people that became that we call the Turks today, some trace them back to ancient Edom. I don't know if that's entirely accurate. We used to as a church, but it was a totally different area. Those people had not migrated. The Turkish people that we call today, that those groups did not exist in that area today. But in this area of Asia Minor, that's where the seven churches were located, and these were established during the third missionary journey of the Apostle Paul from AD 54 to 57. Let's take a look at a very similar church that we have a little bit more record of in the book of Colossians, the book of the Colossians. You're going to see, if you haven't seen it before, if you hadn't heard any of my comment or anybody else commented on it before, there is a very, very special relationship, even though Colossae was not one of the churches mentioned in Revelation 2 and 3. It was definitely a congregation. It was established, and it happened to be right next door to, relatively speaking, within 10 or 15 miles, of Laodicea. So in Colossians chapter 2, we read, Paul says, for I want you to know what great conflict I have for you and those in Laodicea, and for as many as have not seen my face in the flesh. So both Colossae and Laodicea are mentioned together here, and I think that is of some significance because they were close by in proximity. They were relatively close to one another. And my belief is that this is a specific clue, the fact that these two cities, these two churches are mentioned a number of times together in the Bible, actually mentioned six times together in the Bible. I don't know that there's that kind of relationship with two specific areas anywhere else. There may be. But four of those occurrences are in the book of Colossians, in the verse that we just read, also in chapter 4 and verse 13, where we read, "For I bear witness that he has great zeal for you and those who are in Laodicea and those who are in Hierapolis." So that is the second instance here. And then in verse 15, "Give the brethren who are in Laodicea and Nymphis and the church that is in his house," or greet the brethren who are in Laodicea and Nymphis. And then in verse 16, "Now when this epistle is read among you, see that it is read also in the church of the Laodiceans. And you likewise read the epistle from Laodicea." There is an unpublished letter that Paul wrote to the Laodiceans. Why isn't it printed? Well, probably because it was very similar. May have been a few exceptions. It was probably very similar to the letter that was written to next door town, city, whatever, very close proximity, Colossae. So it's possible that some from the territories of the seven churches in Asia first encountered members of the true church of God on the day of Pentecost. As we read in Acts chapter 1 and verse 9, there were people from all over the empire that were there. So it's possible. I'm not saying that it happened, but it sure seems like it could be a possibility. As we read in Acts chapter 1 and verse, maybe it's 2 and verse 9, maybe I misspoke that, yeah. When it talks about all the different peoples that were gathered there in the day of Pentecost, in chapter 2 and verse 9, it says, "Parthians and Medes and Elamites, those dwelling in Mesopotamia and Judea, Cappadocia, Pontus, and Asia." Now, could some of those folks have been there visiting for the holy days? Jews, probably. Could they have been there? Could they have been baptized? Could they have returned to their home area and been a part of the Christian church? I think so. I don't think that that's beyond the realm of possibility. But at any rate, later on, Paul would go there. Missionary journeys. He would establish churches in those areas. And we know that you don't really want to be associated with Laodicea, because Christ says that he's going to vomit that group, that assembly, that ecclesia out of his mouth. Not a good mental picture. Now, the wealth of that area, and it was wealthy, it may have been the wealthiest of the areas in that seven church, and maybe all of Asia Minor as well. I think sometimes people get a little bit mixed up and say, well, you know, we shouldn't be wealthy because that takes our eyes off the ball or off the goal. Well, that's not the point. There were members there who lived in a wealthy area. We don't know if all of them were wealthy, but I don't even believe that those people historically, from a historical standpoint, had the same attributes or the same attitudes as the ones that we read about in Revelation 3. I believe they were probably just like all the other normal churches of that area, who, from a historical standpoint, when you get down to it, they were all a part of the Ephesian era, which began at Pentecost, 31 AD, and then extended all the way up at least until the death of the Apostle John. So I believe they're just the normal group of people facing some of the same difficulties and problems that the people in Ephesus and other areas did. But besides that, Laodicea is described as being wretched, miserable, poor, blind, and naked. And they have this spiritual condition at the time of the end, and they're counseled to buy gold that is refined in the fire so that they may be rich. Well, what does that mean? Well, the Bible explains its symptoms, or its symbols, pardon me. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, we kind of read what those symbols actually mean. If they're being counseled to buy gold, what do they do? What are they supposed to do? What is the warning all about? I can just say this as you're turning there. I hope that this condition never applies to anybody that I'm speaking to today. I really hope it doesn't. But in giving this message, I want to say that I truly believe that we are living in an area that is defined by Laodicean-like attitude. And as we know, At the end of every single admonition that Christ gave to these seven churches in Revelation 2 and verse 3, he says, remember what the Spirit says to the churches. So everybody is expected to look at all of these other churches and remember the warnings, because although that we believe that there are historical antecedents to our group today that go way back and are represented by these various church areas in Revelation 2 and 3, we also recognize the significance of that statement at the end of all of the admonitions to the churches as a clue to help us to understand that any of those conditions can apply to us at any time. And we could, you know, sometimes be guilty of some of the things that are warned about to the other church areas. That's what we have always understood. So they are counseled to buy white garments from Christ so that they're not naked, and also to buy gold. So in 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 11, we read, for no other foundation can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. This is a foundation. Jesus Christ is the foundation of our faith. He's the God of the Old Testament. He's the God of the New Testament. He's the one that interacted with the patriarchs. He's the one that was there with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He's the one that was there with the disciples and the apostles. And that is the foundation. That is the foundation of God's church. Now, if anyone builds on this foundation with gold, silver, precious stone, wood, hay, straw, we're going in a descending order, you know, from gold to silver to precious stones, and then the other stuff's not so good. Wood, hay, and straw, that's going to burn up in a trial, in a fire. Each man's work will become clear, for the day will declare it, because it is revealed by fire, and the fire will test each one's work of what sort it is. And if anyone's work which he has built on it endures, he'll receive a reward. If anyone's work is burned, he will suffer loss, but he himself will be saved, yet so as through fire. Huh. When you compare that with the invitation that is given in Revelation chapter 3 to this era or this group of people, it is hopeful. It is encouraging, and it indicates repentance will take place. Because even though there's something lacking, God will provide a way for these folks who we could say have a Laodicean attitude, who think they're okay, think that they're fine, but are actually wretched, poor, blind, miserable, etc., etc. God has a plan for them. It's not a pleasant thing to consider. It's not pleasant. But ultimately, salvation is possible for them. I believe that is the meaning of this particular verse in verse 14. If anyone's work is burned, he will suffer loss, but he himself will be saved, yet so as through fire. Do you not know that you are the temple of God and that the Spirit of God dwells in you? And if anyone defiles the temple of God, God will destroy him, for the temple of God is holy, which temple you are. So they are counseled to do a number of things, and one of the things is, you know, to be clothed. In Revelation 19 and verse 8, you can jot it down. White garments are the righteousness of the saints. Laodiceans are a group of people that God works with. And who are they? That's not a place that you can point to on a map. It's not a congregation that you can go visit. It's not a place that you can, you know, do a day trip to. But I believe that it is showing a condition of people who, at one time or another, have known better. There's got to be a reason that they are admonished, and I believe that there is a clue as to what that reason is within the Bible. And I think there are other clues that we read about in the New Testament which help us to understand conditions at the time of the end. Now, In the past, I was taught, like many of you, that we as a church, we don't get involved in politics, which we don't. We don't get involved in the governments of this world, which we don't. But neither can we afford to so distance ourselves from what is happening in the world that we become ignorant of what's happening in the world, or think that it doesn't have an effect on our lives, because I believe it does. Some people didn't like, excuse me a second, let me take a drink of water. This is funny, in a tragic sense, I believe. That's my opinion. I better qualify it. Some people have not appreciated, or they think that maybe I've gone a bridge too far, so to speak, in speaking about or talking about or even writing about in my blog about politics. Politics basically does govern your life. And I was speaking to the El Paso group last week and kind of went over something that has been kind of a pet peeve about scriptures like Romans 13, 1 through 7, I believe. I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to give the same information. But basically, there's been this idea among some within even the Church of God that whatever the government tells you to do, just be a good soldier and do it, because that's what you're supposed to do as a Christian. I'm summing up the thought that has been relayed by some regarding three specific scriptures in terms of our response to the governments of this world. Basically, this is the correct explanation. If you haven't heard it before, I'm sorry. But the correct explanation for the admonition in Titus, the admonition in Peter, and the admonition in Romans 13 regarding our interaction with the government is that as long as the government is there to protect us as individuals and keep evil people away from us, then we need to be obedient to it. But when they tell us to do things that are disobedient to God, as it says in Acts 5:29, we ought to obey God rather than men. So I think it's vital for Christians to understand the world that they live in and to have, you know, maybe not be totally into it as I am in terms of understanding what's going on with the politics of this world and what's happening with elections and what the consequences of elections in a free state like the United States of America might be. But I think you better understand something about it, because it has everything to do with your relationship with that world that we live in that we haven't been taken out of. So I do believe that you have to understand that. And if you are able to correctly understand what is happening in your world today, I believe it's possible for you to be a better Christian and to pray thy kingdom come in a better way, rather than just assume, okay, this side is bad, and this side, because they're not in the church and they're not representing God's government, because they're this way, they're both bad, or they're both equally bad. Well, you know, sometimes that can be true. I won't deny it, but not for the reasons that most people assume. For instance, I kind of draw the line when, and I mentioned this to the people in El Paso, I draw the line when a politician wants to kill babies, okay? And it's not that abortion is bad, is really, really bad of and by itself, and it's really been bad, and it's been bad as long as it's ever gone on. But when you have states that pass laws that allow doctors or nurses or the medical personnel to kill babies after birth, if that is the wish of the mother, what have we come to? What have we come to as a world and as a society? And if you are not sensitized to that, shame on you. You have to be aware that these laws are being passed. I'll tell you a story. Going back to my medical career, I've never told this story before, but Years ago, we were able to do this in the pharmaceutical industry, in a pharmaceutical business, that we could shadow doctors. The company would pay the doctor a fee for us to just, you know, spend a day with a doctor, you know, just be able to follow him around, and he would seek the permission of all the patients. You haven't been able to do this. You came in too late. But we were able to do it back in the day. It was kind of interesting. It was kind of, some things were interesting. The situation I'm going to explain to you is not so interesting. But we were able to shadow the physician to see what a normal day was like in the physician's life. And that way, you could better comprehend kind of the pressures and the difficulties that they were under. And I thought it was very valuable. And I learned a lot for, you know, a number of times. I did probably five or six times throughout the years. My company, whatever company I was working for, pay a fee to the doctor, let me tag along. But he always had to get the permission of the patient for an industry representative to be in, you know, because of HIPAA laws and all that. The patient said fine. A couple times they said no, but that's okay. But you've all been in doctors' offices. You know the door. It's got a little folder area there. The doctor takes your chart out and looks at it. And so we come to a door, and I didn't know what his schedule was like, but we're probably seeing 8-9 patients on a regular day, maybe more than that. Some are, don't take as much time. But he takes the chart and he flips it open. And he says, okay, this is going to be interesting for you. I was shadowing that day an endocrinologist. He deals with all the endocrine functions in the body, all of the various organs. You know, some people would say, well, they would concentrate on diabetes or thyroid or parathyroid or any of the glands. So this particular time, he looked at me, and he later became a very good friend. He says, well, you're going to like this. I'm like, no, you're not, but yeah. But anyway, so he peeks his head in, and he speaks to the patient. He says, hey, I've got an industry representative shadowing me today. You know, do you mind if he comes in and observes? And, you know, the person said, no, that's fine. I get in there, and I find out, and this was about 20 years ago, and there's a place up in Colorado, southern Colorado, Trinidad, Colorado, in which they specialize in a special type of surgery, and it was basically for people who wanted to change their gender. It was kind of basically rare back in those days, but it was a booming business in this one area, and it was a place where people would go to change from man to woman, woman to man. I mean, you can't really do that, right? I mean, it's not possible, but in this case, he did a full examination. It was really very creepy in a way, because this person was a woman who was, you know, felt like she identified more with being a man, and, you know, she had been taking male hormones, testosterone. She had, you know, beard, very wispy beard and everything, but she was taking massive amounts of male hormone. I don't know what that does to you later on. I'm sure it's not good. I'm sure it messes you up a lot, but it was eye-opening. But in the last couple of years, what have we seen emerge from the medical scene and from the political scene is this transgender movement. And it's going down even to little children now. This is demonic. This is crazy. I understand the frustration that someone may have at a very early age, in which maybe they are, you know, they feel out of sorts or whatever, but enough people have gone through this and come back on the other side when they're adults and said, the worst decision I have ever made in my life. But this is the kind of deviancy that is being normalized for the general population. It's okay to kill babies. It's okay for people to have themselves mutilated. It's okay for little children even to have their genitals cut off or changed or whatever weirdness that is going on. Do you understand that 25 years ago, 30 years ago, this was insanity and considered insanity by the world even? It's being normalized. There are many other things that are being normalized that are very deviant behaviors in our world today. You as a Christian are responsible for understanding the political processes that make this happen. I'm not saying get immersed and involved in politics, but government politics allow this to happen. Don't be don't be a person that is going to stick your head in the sand, because this is what is, you know, even this past week, in the past political process and elections, this is what has happened. Also, a lot of other things that are happening in the world today that are being normalized are criminal behaviors. And the acceptance of such by many in our society shows the normalization of it, or the kind of the fait accompli, we can't do anything about it. Please understand the world in which you live is changing rapidly. And I believe, as it is mentioned in Revelation 12, Satan was cast out of this earth, and I think it was a one-time event that happened before mankind's creation. But I believe that that devil who was cast down to earth, Jesus Christ said, I saw Satan fall from heaven like lightning. I believe that his intensity is picking up. And I think that we can see that very easily in the normalization of very deviant behavior, which may include and very likely does include the kind of fraud and cheating that people have just come to accept. Or how can you prove it or say this? But I'm telling you that I've told you before, I've been a student of politics for many, many years. I've been an observer of the political scene for many, many years. I have never seen things happen more rapidly on the political scene than they have in the last couple of years. I don't expect anyone to necessarily think that this is the be-all and the end-all of understanding prophecy or truth or whatever. But I think that if you just throw everybody into the same basket and say everybody in the world bad, everybody in the church good, I think that you are really naive. And I think on the plus side, I have never seen so many candidates, not only in our own state of Arizona, but also throughout the United States, I've never seen a response to what a lot of people view in the past couple of years as this deviancy becoming normalized throughout society and their desire to serve their country by running for political office with no apparent gain on even a local state level here, a gubernatorial level. I think that from what I have seen, I think my discernment's pretty good. I don't think I'm an idiot, but I think that I've seen incredible people who say, I'm rising up to the occasion because we have got to stop what is going on. We've got to stop what is happening in our schools. We've got to stop what is happening on the southern border. We've got to stop the attack on our children and education and the vulgar and the profane things that are being taught within school systems. There are a bunch of people that have done that throughout the country, and unfortunately, a lot of them have been defeated under very spurious and difficult circumstances. It's very difficult for me to believe that some of the people who have run for office, going back to the presidential election, actually received votes. And I think there's a good case to be made for the massive fraud and cheating and the determination to turn this country from the greatest country in the world by its leadership. It's not accidental. It's not, and I used to believe that prophecy would be fulfilled and the problems in our nation would be fulfilled because of ineptness and stupidity. I don't any longer. It's deliberate. It's intended. We're not dealing with dumb people. But think about it. The rest of the English-speaking peoples of the world, including Great Britain, New Zealand, Australia, the United Kingdom, all of them have fallen under the sway of very strange and dark and sinister forces. I'm very serious about this. They alone cannot stop the problems which I believe are a satanic movement and force. The United States is the only nation still that allows free speech, and of course that's being attacked by a combination of government and media. People are being deplatformed, people are being silenced, the expression of their viewpoint is being limited. This is not the normal flow politically, ebb and flow. It cannot be. We live in a changing and tumultuous world. And we don't know even yet the totality of the election results that will happen. But it's not looking good. It's not looking good. Which leads us back to a Laodicean approach and frame of mind and attitude. And the idea that if you want to understand what happens or how to avoid this Laodicean attitude and living in this tumultuous world that we live in and still retain what I believe is true for you and many other people who will be watching this webcast or may watch the sermon later on, for you to be able to avoid the problems of becoming poor, blind, wretched, miserable, and naked, all of these things are symbols for action on the part of God's people, things that are good to do. And when you take a look at the association of Colossae, and you see the association of that six times in the Bible with Laodicea, which I think was a fine place back in the day, but from a prophetic standpoint and understanding, you don't want to be there. You can't go there today. It's not there. It is an attitude of mind. You know, why does it say in 2 Peter chapter 3, for instance, that the Lord delays his coming? Why will that be an expression or an attitude by somebody at some point during the time of the end? I believe it is a Laodicean attitude. Why are in Matthew 25, for instance, why is there five wise virgins, five foolish virgins? What has happened? Why is there in Revelation chapter 12, I know this is maybe a little bit hard for you to follow, but I'm kind of running out of time. Why is there in Revelation 12 a group of people that are protected by God during the time of the great tribulation from the face of the serpent? And why is that serpent then angry and then returns and goes to attack the remnant of her seed? Because, bold opinion, just take it for what it's worth, I believe there is a group of people who may know better during the time of the great tribulation who are not protected. And I think all of those things to begin to add up. But when you couple as a protective thing about, as a protective measure for those of you that are really kind of staying with me so far, acting as a Christian is the right thing to do. Being here is the right thing to do. Keeping the holy days is the right thing to do. Not just in, you know, just showing up. I mean, that's a part of it. I mean, that's a physical thing. But understanding that through that process of the Sabbath day, which pictures a rest period of 1,000 years, and understanding each of the holy days in their totality leads us to salvation, paves the way for us to salvation, takes us on a road and a journey to salvation by helping us to understand the meaning of those days. The fact that you're here and that you went to the feast or you did all those things means that's important to you. Don't ever let go of that. But also don't let go of the fact that, you know, Paul mentions in Colossians chapter 4 and verse 7 that being a good neighbor is an important thing. Now, he mentions a bunch of people here in Colossians 4. He mentions Tychius, who is a beloved brother and a faithful minister in Colossians 4 and verse 7. He mentions Onesimus, a faithful and beloved brother who is one of you. In verse 10, he talks about Aristarchus, my fellow prisoner, greets you, and Mark, the cousin of Barnabas. He mentions in verse 12, Epaphras, who is one of you, is a bondservant. Now, Paul is going to great lengths to mention some heavy hitters in the faith, Tychus, Onesimus, Aristarchus, Mark, Jesus, or Jesus, and Justice, Epaphras, Luke, and Demas. Tychus is called elsewhere as a beloved brother and a faithful minister in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 21. Why would he mention these individuals by name? Because their example counts. He also mentions other individuals by name as well in a not so good light in various times, people that made a shipwreck of their faith. Aristarchus is mentioned five different times in the Bible. He was a Macedonian. I mean, for him to have that honorable mention five times in the Bible shows that he did some amazing things. He was from Greece, but he accompanied Paul on his third and fourth journeys and ended up a prisoner with Paul in Rome. Mark was the younger cousin of Barnabas, but he reunited with Paul later, as well as with Peter. And of course, he wrote the Gospel of Mark. You could go on and on about the work of these individuals. And that gets us back to the problems of Laodicea. If you're not in the game, if you're at one time, if you knew the truth and departed from it, and you're not really paying attention to it, then I'm told that this analogy is wrong, by the way, but I'm going to use it anyway because people understand it. You don't want to be like the frog on slow burn and then eventually just boils as the flame gets hotter. I'm told that, you know, that doesn't happen. You know, somebody told me that that is not really a good analogy, but we all understand it. You know, the gradual increase of temperature, you just get used to it and you get boiled alive. Somebody told me that's not true. You know, you throw a frog into a boiling pot and he hops out, right? You've heard that. But if you're doing a cold water and then get it hotter, apparently that's not true, but I don't know. I haven't checked it out. But you all understand the analogy. We're living in a society that, even if the analogy is false, we're living in a society which wants to boil us alive slowly, gradually. Works are important. Our conduct is important. What we do is important. Now, God has already called us with the promise of salvation, but we need to follow through. And I believe that that is the main thing wrong with this church that is mentioned in the last two chapters. So the age in which we live, which I believe is very important, deviancy normalized, murder basically legalized on many scales, people sensitive sometimes about what is being taught. You know, people react sometimes, oh, that is either way too political, that is way too hard line, and people that are getting offended, people that get offended because the society has told them that high standards are too much. Could be, I'm not saying it is, but it could be a sign of a Laodicean attitude, because if we've got to govern ourselves by what is politically correct, then we may as well all go home, because this is not the place for political correctness as judged by a society that is becoming more and more deviant by the minute. This is not the place for you if you're offended by politically incorrect speech as defined by the world, the decadent world in which we live. Luke chapter 12 and verse 46, as we finish this up. Luke chapter 12 and verse 45, I'm sorry. If that servant says in his heart, my master is delaying his coming, and begins to beat the male and female servants and to eat and drink and be drunk, the master of that servant will come in a day when he's not looking for him and at an hour when he is not aware, and will cut him in two and appoint him with his portion for the unbelievers. So how do we reconcile this paradox of Laodicea? If I say that Christ vomits this church out of his mouth, and very possibly into the midst of a great tribulation because they failed to keep his law and forgot about his plan of salvation, how can Christ accurately say that very possibly this same group keeps the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ at the end of Revelation chapter 12? How do you reconcile that entire paradox? Well, I believe that's explained in Revelation 7 in verses 10 through 16, and you can read that on your own, because I think along with a great innumerable multitude who are saved through the time of the great tribulation through the cleansing fire, I think that we will see eventually a number of those who may have been categorized into this group of Laodicean. They will finally see themselves, they will buy gold, and they'll have white clothing, which is fitting for God's saints. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches.